Comedy Studio for the 12th Sunday in Ordinary Time. That is Sunday the 21st of June. This is the shortest day in our part of the world. Who do we have in our conversation today?
Kia tata, everyone. My name's Kathleen Petrie. I have a background in education, but I'm now retired, and I live in Devonport in Auckland. And I have six children, one of whom is visiting at the moment.
Kia ora, everybody. My name is Colin McLeod. I look after the National Centre for Religious Studies, which is part of Te Kupinga down here in beautiful sunny Dunedin.
Okay. And kia ora, everyone. I'm Bernadette Patilaseo. I come to you from Wainuiomata. I'm a mother of five and grandmother of 10, and I'm the full-time caregiver for my mother. And I came to Homily Studio as a launch out graduate, which I did at the end of last year.
It's been great to have you, Bernadette. I know they've only been on a couple of times, but we have two or three of the launch out candidates from Wellington, and it's great to have you on board. So I've just said to those who are listening, wherever you are welcome. And I've just said to everyone here that I think these were tough readings. I don't know if sometimes that some days the scriptures just don't speak to me at all. And everyone else says, wow, what great readings they are. So my hope is that the three of you are feeling very vocal today. Yes, I am hopeful. Let's begin in prayer. Again, wherever you are, Bernadette, you mentioned a little bit about your life, including caring for your mother, but people who are listening to this in all kinds of places are caring for those who are needy or vulnerable, or struggling with those who've got too much energy, or difficulties with health, with finance. Look, there's so many things that can weigh us down, but we are people of hope. And that's why we turn to our loving God. In the entrance antiphon for this Sunday, the Lord is the strength of his people, a saving refuge for the one he has anointed. Save your people, Lord, and bless your heritage. Govern us forever. The Lord is the strength of his people, a saving refuge. Well, I'm feeling more hopeful already. Maybe there is something in these scriptures for this week.
Well, Jeremiah was eternally hopeful.
Indeed.
Yeah, without a great deal of evidence of hope in his life, you know, with all that persecution. I got thinking about persecution when I read these readings, particularly the gospel, because this comes in between, or rather the last week we had the call of the 12, and in this Sunday's passage we've got Jesus warning them about how dangerous it's going to be, but and reassuring them that he's with them to the end of time. But I thought we're not really being persecuted today. We're not. The big thing that we've got to worry about is apathy.
I think you're right, Kath, but I'm thinking that the emphasis of that gospel bit is, are we too quiet about it? And I found myself reflecting on it, you know, what does persecution look like? Is there a type of persecution in secular New Zealand when I'm sitting on a bus, conscious that I'm surrounded by people who probably have no sense of faith whatsoever? I've got no necessarily reason to think that. They could be surrounded by faithful people, but I think they're not. So I'm inclined to not mention maybe the job that I do or the feelings that I might be thinking that are to done with faith. So while there's not an overt persecution, there's a passive persecution that we participate in, and the gospel saying, hey, speak up.
And maybe the persecution is the apathy, Kath, that you mentioned. Like, I think it's, you know, we always think of persecution as being people coming at us ready to attack us, to martyr us, to put us to death, to speak loudly against us. But We live in a climate, in a world where people are saying, if you want to be Christian, that's fine. If you don't want to be Christian, that's fine too. If you want to go to church, that's fine. If you don't want to go to church, that's fine too. And I find that kind of like that kind of lack of energy in people, I find that very difficult. In fact, I find it much easier when people directly attack what I say or do. There's sort of an openness to dialogue there. People do care.
They do. I was my mind went more to being perhaps persecuted within the church. And won't name or shame anybody, but I was thinking of times when my children, who are all well and truly grown now, so I can say this, were perhaps not bringing glory to our family name. And you know, those times were difficult, but I also thought of the persecution in these readings as in the gospel. There's the contrast between darkness and light, and so the persecution or the feeling that one might associate with persecution can be experienced on your own in personal darkness, I think, as well.
Bernadette, you're taking us back into Jeremiah as well. It's those whisperings around. It's not
Exactly, yeah.
necessarily the things we hear, but it's the
Yes.
voices and what might they be saying. And I suppose he sort of just prompted me to think as it's peer pressure part of those whisperings. What is expected of me and how am I being judged and how do I respond? I think there's a long tradition of that, isn't there? Within Christianity, there's a tradition of needing to measure up, despite the fact, as in the gospel again, Jesus's expectations are a lot lower than we might otherwise think. Faith in him—that's the central element, and here
That's
we're hearing,
right.
yeah.
And what is whispered to us in the darkness is what we're called to take out there to the world. And we find God equally in the darkness and in the light.
Bernadette, I'm going to pick up a point you made earlier, persecution within the church. And I think that at the time of my ordination 40 years ago now, I knew there would be persecution, but my presumption was that the persecution would come from those people out there, not us in here. But in fact, most of my struggle and suffering and feeling of being persecuted has come from people who call themselves Catholic. And that's actually a very difficult persecution. I'm also thinking of the statistic in New Zealand is that about 95% of baptized Catholics, and I don't know what the statistic is for other denominations, but 95% of baptized Catholics have no contact with Sundays at all. Some of them, a very small percentage, are connected with schools, but in fact, that only brings us, there's over 90% are not connected with parishes or schools. And some of it, I have to say, when people tell their stories, are with good reason. The reasons that people go to Mass and then say that they don't go, I really understand. Like people say, oh, no, they're just making up an excuse. It's about the music. Well, recently I was at a place where the music at the Mass, it just drove me nuts. It was just awful. Now, I can't say this aloud, so please, the three of you, don't tell anyone else. But I just want to say to people who struggle with that, I really do too. And it wasn't that people weren't really trying, it was that they were trying too hard. But often, I often say that some of the most beautiful liturgies I've ever been to, and I name particular churches. In places like Cheviot, where there might be a dozen people, or Harden, where there might be about the same number, very small community that sing very simply, just the Alleluia verse or one or two other things, and maybe, praise to the Lord, which they've sung every Sunday for 50 years. It's beautiful. And often the difficulties for people come when the priest tries too hard, or the music's trying too hard, or the entertainment group, or the witnesses, or the coffee group are all just trying too hard. And if we just let the Lord do the work through the simplicity of the Eucharist, often that's all people really want and need. Anyhow, I finished my little rant at this point.
That's good. I love the phrase I heard many, many years ago, the reason that 90% of Catholics don't go to Mass is because of the 10% that do. And the
Colin,
bit I
that's
love
right.
about that phrase is that I'm one of the 10%. I'm one of the 10%, you know. So the beauty of a phrase like that is you can fire it out and it becomes sort of other until you take a moment and think, oh, hang on, I'm participating in this. Well, what are the bits that I'm doing? And I think, John, that linked to the trying too hard is a sort of a misplaced despair. So I think that the idea of, you know, what are the traps with saying that that's the Eucharist that is all that is needed? Or what's the bit of Eucharist then? Is it the gathering? Is it the experience of Christ in the form of the bread and the wine? Is it the homily? And so we need to be invested. We can't step by and say, okay, there's just the stuff of the Mass. Otherwise, we end up, I think, where the church was 40, 50 years ago, where in actual fact there was a piece of magic that you just sort of turned up to, connected with in some way, and walked out. Something is asked of us, but it's not necessarily in those better music all the time, or better, whatever it is. So you know, it, yeah.
Okay, I just have to come in here, Colin, because I think, okay, it's good that you're raising this, and I do think it needs to be examined a little bit, because in fact, it's not just a problem that we do too much of that, or it's always a yes and. So yes, it is the reality of the Eucharist, Christ present in people gathered, yes, in Eucharist, yes, in word, yes, in what we do when we go from this place during the week, yes, all of those things. And I think when one becomes, maybe this is what you are suggesting here, when one of them becomes the total focus, like when we focus, Christ is present only in the Eucharist. Well, Eucharist's a big word, and it actually means the ways that I give thanks for the life of God on a Wednesday as well.
Yes.
I think we're agreeing. And
We are.
I would agree, Colin. I think often one's experience of Eucharist leaves you coming out not saying thanks be to God, but my God, that was awful. So how do then do we appear as those 10%? How do we exercise the mission of attraction? Because that's what it's about in terms of evangelization, that people will look at us or experience something that we do or say and think, I want what she's got, I want what she's having.
The thing that I found myself focusing on was this phrase where, do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, rather be afraid of the one who can destroy both body and soul. And the awakening for me in sort of doing a little bit of research around this, of course, it's not referring to Satan, it's referring to God as the one who can destroy. But the context is critical, because the context of it is that we can lose this relationship with God. We can turn away from it, and it can become as nothing. And God, if you like, has the authority to ratify our decision. We can end up in hell, absence, utter absence of God and God's love through our own decisions. And I think sometimes I can do that when I turn up to Eucharist. I think sometimes I could be coming with my own backpack full of what I'm expecting and what I'm giving, and in actual fact, God isn't the central element. My relationship with God, which requires my relationship with others. Okay, I'm not talking about a little silo, but the whole point of coming together for Eucharist is that we engage as community. That's what connects us to the body of Christ. That's what connects us to the God whom we believe. So this sort of the despair that we were talking about earlier of, if you like, well, negative experiences and disempowering and soul-destroying experiences of liturgy, where we have an opportunity, and I am being optimistic here, we have an opportunity to participate and help grow ourselves, grow the community. Bernadette, you're
Yeah,
nodding.
I am. So as a faithful member of the 10% and a church musician, John, please come to our church. it's yeah, I have so many thoughts about that, but you just have to do it anyway. As a church musician, I have had to just do it anyway. And then when I'm in the pews and not loving the music, it is a decision because it for me as a musician, it is more than a distraction. It's an assault on my ears when the music is bad. It's a violence. And that takes me away from what I'm in the mass for. And so it's a decision to remind myself why I'm there. So I think you said yes, and I think you're all correct in everything that you've said about that.
I'm reminded, Bernadette, as you say that, of a I was in Winton of all places about 12 months ago for a parish retreat, and one person suggested, and I didn't quite hear what they said, and I asked them to repeat. They said the best kept secret in the church is weekday mass,
Yes, it's a
and
different thing.
everyone understood what they meant. That there's a simplicity. It doesn't take a huge amount of organization. Where there's a simplicity, a gentleness. There's plenty of room for silence. There's often singing, which is fine, but it's not like we're trying to make it into a command performance.
Well, and if I can pick up on what you were saying about that, we ourselves have the power to separate us from God and cast ourselves into some kind of hell. That's what Paul is saying in the letter to the Romans, and you know that doctrine of original sin is very hard for people to come to grips with. You know, people, particularly people joining the church for the first time in RCIA or inquiry groups, the idea that we're born into sin, and you know, because we are human. But I think there's a link back to the gospel in because we are sinful people, because we have the temptation to separate ourselves from the love of God and also from the love of others. We're prone to fear of the world in general, and the world itself is doing its best to stimulate a climate of fear. When you think about what's going on in the world and the politics of populist leaders who are inviting us to fear one another rather than to love one another, I think that idea that of fearing no one and knowing that every single one of us, even the outsider, even those who are different, are loved more than many sparrows.
Kath, I think that's a very, well, I know that's a very, very powerful point. You're sounding a little bit like Pope Leo in the encyclical, Magnificent Humanity. What a great title for an encyclical. Because we do, there is a danger, and has been certainly in the past, where the church fears the world. And of course, the great event of trying to break down those walls, it was the Second Vatican Council, which helped us to see that our job is not to create a holy little perfect ghetto called the church, where everything exists on this little bit of land. The church and the schools and the rugby club and all of those things are real ghetto. But the place for the church is in the world, fearlessly in the world, because with Christ we have nothing to fear.
Yeah, and I think that that links a little to the sort of the overflowing of God's grace as well. That's in the Romans reading as well. That if you like, the bad stuff is trumps. Oh, terrible phrase! I don't know how that
Oh.
came out of my mouth. Please read it in its most positive sense. Is overrun by the grace of God. Look, as a link to it. Years ago, as I was teaching young people, and we were talking about original sin, and we'd got into the area of the idea that before baptism, that a baby is born stained by original sin, and I struggled with it, and the kids struggled, but we're pitching it as church teaching, and I read an article, just happened to be in the staff room, it was open on, and it was at the New Scientist magazine, and it was talking about the original the the reality of original sin in the human form. And what it was talking about was that every child is born stained. They have from their inheritance a propensity to heart condition or say mental health or all of these things that every child is born with genetically programmed into their being. This negative potential in terms of oh, and a positive potential too in terms of those that live to old age, often that goes through generations. And I thought it's a really interesting link, this idea that the person does inherit. We don't exist solely in our own right and on our own little island, if you like, but that what has gone before impacts us. So why not the sin of Adam? The metaphor that is that we are born with this innate propensity to not choose right. And then to have that trumped by Jesus giving us this overt symbol, of grace.
Yeah, look, I can see that. I'm a bit struggling with the way you keep on using the word trumped. I think you need to take it to your supervisor, Colin. It's just a tad distracting. But so we use the term original sin, and okay, we accept that it's part of the church's teaching. And I think your explanation there, Colin, from the New Scientist is very helpful. But what if we add and say, okay, yes, to all of that. Now let's talk about original grace. Like the original divine intention for us, the action of God, the love of God. So if we're talking about, we can only talk about original sin, and in fact, original sin only makes it if we're also talking equally and even more powerfully actually, about original grace.
What do you mean by original, John?
Oh, look,
Grace
it comes to
of
mind.
creation,
Okay, look, do you
grace
know who
that.
comes to mind, and I actually have to say I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the focus on Carlo Acutis in Aotearoa in these days. But anyhow, that's my own stuff. If it helps people's faith, I'm delighted. But personally, but Acutis used this, he gave this quote, he said, "We're all born as originals and die as photocopies." And I really like the quote from Carlo Acutis because, each of us is completely original. What do I mean by original? Never been before, unique, will never be repeated, a one-off communication of a particular aspect of God that nobody else can communicate. That's our originality. But we fall into, and perhaps as much as anywhere else in the church, we fall into an attachment or a desire to unity and uniformity rather than original diversity. And our role in the world has to be to help people to live originally their originality. Is that a satisfactory answer, Colin? To you
It's
dropping in
a
on the spot there?
useful. I mean, what's the job of these conversations is to get us thinking, isn't it? As
Indeed.
to sort of you've added another sort of line for me to head down and to dwell in
Bernadette.
afterwards.
Bernadette, you're ready to go then.
Yeah, sort of. Or wade in. It's just interesting that you brought up grace because I was thinking when I was reflecting on the gospel about it's very fearful and that we should be afraid, but I tend to think more of the awe or awesomeness of God and his grace, that it's a healthy fear. That we should have. And then when you're talking about original sin, I was thinking it's our humanity. It's just we're human. It's original sin, which is all of what you're all saying. And particularly Colin, when you were speaking about your description of it, I was thinking, yeah, and that transcends cultures and traditions as well, that idea that we carry stuff forward and that we're born with that.
Yes.
So I'm sitting on the fence and agreeing with everybody.
If I can go back to the idea of original grace, when you think about the creation story, and the goodness of God and the good intentions of God that were emphasized by the Hebrew mythology, that God wanted human beings to have a graced life. You know, he wanted them to have perpetual, to live a long time, to be happy, to enjoy the fruits of creation. And that grace is still there, but we don't tap into it often enough. We tend to think of God as a person who wants to punish us for the wrongdoing, for all the separations that we incur, the sins that we commit when we miss the mark. But God is still, God loves us more than many sparrows and wants the best for
And
us.
it's such a simple phrase to cover this profoundly deep theology that sits, did Jesus bring grace or reestablish grace? Was there a possibility that Jesus may never have been needed? That if humanity had lived to its fullness from the start, may we never have needed the Messiah? And when Jesus came, what did he open in us? The grace that we'd already received that could come out. This notion we could go to many, 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 many places to actually try and it's all about relationship. It's all
And
about that relationship with
I
God.
wonder if some of those questions you asked there, Colin, can be answered. Is there a possibility that if we hadn't gone wrong in the beginning, we wouldn't need Jesus? And the answer is a definite yes. However, that's why at the Easter Vigil we sing, "O happy fault, O necessary sin of Adam that brought us a so great a redeemer." So thanks be to God for Adam and Eve is all we can say. And in fact, can I just add this personally before we each drop in a take home, that our personal sin, our communal sin, has a positive dimension, and that is that when we acknowledge it, it becomes our capacity for a more profound encounter with Christ. The same sort of true in human relationships. Like if I'm in a relationship with someone and we're always both perfect, well, that's great. But when one messes up, seeks forgiveness, and there's forgiveness given, the relationship is even deeper than it was before. A necessary fault. So a take home.
Pray for grace.
Pray for grace.
Hooray for grace, I
Oh,
see.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Hooray for grace. Hooray for grace.
Grace is. Grace just is.
Oh.
Know that God is found or revealed in the darkness. I'm deep into Ignatian stuff at the moment, and I love the idea that we shouldn't want he healing or sickness, that God is found equally in both, that sort of thing. So God is found and revealed in the darkness to be spoken into the light.
Oh.
I'm going to steal a phrase from Bishop Steve Lowe that I heard over a meeting at the weekend. He talked about the grace of God, which enables me to face the past with gratitude, the present with enthusiasm, and the future with confidence.
Repeat it, Kath. Past.
The grace of God
Yeah.
enables me to face the past with gratitude, the present with enthusiasm, and remembering that enthusiasm is that inspiration of God, of the Holy Spirit, and the future with confidence.
I think you've just given us our closing prayer, Kath.